Welcome to the Affordable Freedom Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Hune. Our mission is to help you gain your freedom from the exhausting, never-ending corporate rat race. Because time is our most valuable asset. And life's just too short to do work we hate. Thanks for slowing down. All right, welcome to the Affordable Freedom Podcast, everyone. My guest today is a fellow financial planner, Josh St. Laurent. And Josh and I have traveled similar paths. We started on the corporate side of the financial advice industry, working for really large firms. And just like myself, Josh started his own firm. And right now he is a financial planner with the name of his firm is Wealth in Yourself. He's also an adjunct professor of finance at Golden Gate University, and he runs a podcast as well, which is called the Wealth in Yourself podcast. So Josh, should be a good conversation today. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. I had some topics, Don, that I wanted to get into, but as I was reading your intro there, a thought sparked into my head. You're an adjunct professor of finance, which I think is really cool, because one of the things that I've been talking about a lot recently and I'm very passionate about is that our industry needs to start moving more in the direction of education, teaching people and empowering people to do well with their finances and build wealth. And if we can do that, they'll probably want to keep us around as their advisors. I think there's this fear in our industry that if you teach and you give away too much information, that people aren't going to want to pay you for your services anymore. So I'm just curious to hear your take on that.
It's a great question. I'll share a little bit of my story in my answer too. I mean, really my journey to go back to school and then ultimately become a professor was because of that corporate finance environment that you're talking about. And the focus was always on sales and not so much on education and coaching. And I knew that that was a missing piece. And so I went and sought that out, had such a profound impact on me as a student that I basically approached the director of the financial planning department and said, hey, is there any way that I can help out? And that sort of led me down the path of teacher's assistant and then a professor. But you're absolutely right. Like the education component is what so many people are actually seeking out as financial planning clients. There is a small fraction of people, I'm sure you see this in your practice, who really do want to be hands off, but there are a lot of people who are seeking out the education behind it. Well, why are we making these decisions? What went into that decision? And they want that education to know for themselves and also help people in their inner circles too.
Yeah. And I feel like the education part, it just helps to establish a lot more trust. If I go in, for example, and this is an analogy I've used in the past, but if I go into a car mechanic and the car mechanic teaches me exactly what he's going to be doing and why it needs to be done, could I go and do it myself? Maybe. I think I could order the parts and I could work on the car and do it. Do I want to? No. So I think when there's education, then there's a level of trust and people feel more comfortable working with you. And that just leads to better outcomes. And that's what we want, is great outcomes for our clients.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned it at the beginning, you know, there's a fear in a lot of professional industries. I won't harp on just financial advisors, but there is this belief that you don't want to give away too much information. I had a business coach tell me once, you know, you got to give away everything for free, all the information, all the knowledge. Really what you're selling is the implementation. And that sort of stuck with me because it's so true in a lot of professional service industries. I would say especially financial planning. You can teach someone all that you know about, you know, Roth conversions. They still want you there by their side to help them do the Roth conversion, make sure everything is processed correctly. Inevitably, life is going to happen and there'll be a curveball thrown in the mix. You know, they get laid off from their job. Well, now you have a new problem. What do I do with this old 401k? And so financial plan to me is sort of a misnomer. It's really financial planning. It's an ongoing thing that you do. And the more you build that relationship, the more you can help someone.
Yeah. And a big part of that about why people want to have you by their side comes down to the emotional side of dealing with our money. It can take us on an emotional roller coaster. And a lot of times if emotions are running too high, it's hard for you to make rational decisions and do the things that you need to do to get the results that you want to get. So I know you are actually a certified financial therapist, which is something that I'm not very familiar with. I want to learn more about, but I would love for you to tell us a little bit about what that means.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll back up just a bit. So at Golden Gate, my major was financial life planning, and there was some required courses along the way. And so the way that I think about financial therapy is if you consider like the CFP curriculum, right? That's sort of your present financial reality. We could gather all the statements. Here's your balances. Here's what you're contributing. This is sort of your present financial scenario. If you think about financial coaching, that's sort of forward looking. What goals can we set? What actions can we take to actually change the future? Financial therapy, I think of as almost backwards looking. Like, what ingrained messages do you have around money? What bad financial habits were passed down to you by your parents? And we all have these, you know, money scripts that are sort of ingrained in us that define how we think about or handle money. You know, if you think about the type of person who says, you know, money doesn't grow on trees versus the person who gives away all their money when they get paid, right? Two very different responses. And a lot of times opposites attract when it comes to couples. And so sometimes you'll see that in couples where they have very different money scripts and it causes a rift in the relationship. So to answer your question, financial therapy is really like examining your past with money, using that to better understand how you interact with money now. And how do we sort of reshape those messages to get you a better relationship with money and stop doing some of the things that are really getting in the way of you building wealth?
So as far as money scripts go, what have you seen as kind of the most useful way to think about money? And then on top of that, I was wondering, you know, if somebody doesn't have that mindset, where do you begin to try to start reshaping it?
It's a really good question. I thought something that's interesting about money scripts is there isn't like a end goal, you know, holy grail of, well, I have, you know, this money script and now I'm good. So the quote unquote good money script, you know, that we're usually trying to bolster in people is money vigilance. So it's something that's typically off the chart for a financial planner. It's someone who's very focused on their finances. It's in their face. They have a schedule of visiting and looking at their finances. They're probably saving on a regular basis. They're probably monitoring their spending and very conscious of it. But too much of a good thing can be a bad thing, right? You can see people who are overly money vigilant and it gets in their way. They won't take that trip that they've been dreaming of. They won't, you know, take their significant other out to that nice dinner because they're worried about the cost. And so there's a balance in everything. I would say as financial planners, some of the other scripts to think about, and we've all seen clients like this, maybe just didn't subconsciously know, hey, this is that money script sort of presenting itself. But you'll see people who are money avoidant. These are the people who, you know, pick up a $20 bill they found on the ground and immediately give it away to someone else. I've had clients like that. You have people who are, you know, money status, you know, they're buying the expensive cars and the expensive clothes and shoes, and money to them is a way to outwardly present themselves to the world. And so there's these, you know, there's lots, I mean, hundreds of different money scripts that can sort of present themselves in people. Not any of them are inherently bad, but you wouldn't want to be really high money avoidant, for example, right? That's not congruent to building wealth. So the second part of your question was, well, where do you even begin? And typically it's, you know, have them do some sort of assessment that will let them know, well, here's some of the main money scripts that you have. And then it's really just a conversation about, well, what do you think about that? Where do you think that stemmed from? And how is that showing up in your life now? And most people can almost right away pinpoint, wow, that's crazy. I never thought about that. My dad always said money doesn't grow on trees. My mom always said it. They always work two jobs. And that message was passed down to me. Now look at me. I work two jobs. I hoard money, right? And it's like, how do we break that and say, okay, well, you know, how would you like to be showing up around money? What is that relationship that, you know, you would feel really good about and would sort of free you to not be avoiding money in that way?
So it sounds like just the awareness of what your money script is maybe is even more important than what the money script is. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. And then what are the habits that are behind it? You know, you have this belief and it's got to be showing up in your actions somehow. And so the first step really is like acknowledging, and some people are very well aware of it and some people are shocked. So that's kind of the first step is well, what is showing up in your life? What beliefs and also what actions? And then it becomes baby steps of like, well, what's one action that we could maybe replace slowly over time that would make a monumental difference? You know, maybe it's, I can't help but, you know, spend money on XYZ every time I get paid. And maybe the solution is, well, we're just going to set aside $20 into your savings and we'll just build that small habit. But it's something that we can build upon. And typically just changing that usually lifelong habit is a major milestone for a lot of people. And it really snowballs into building wealth quickly.
Yeah. Having that awareness of how you view money and what your behaviors are so important, because then you can start to create a plan around who you are as an individual. Of course, you know, there's things that we want to improve and we want to always evolve and get better, but start with where you are right now and build a plan around that that's going to work for you and keep you disciplined. Because ultimately, if you stay disciplined to a plan, good things are probably going to happen.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
So, Josh, one of the things that you and I connect on pretty passionately, I would say, is the new industry model of a flat fee structure versus the historical financial advice models of selling commission products or charging a percentage of the assets that we manage for clients. And, you know, I'm also a flat fee advisor. I strongly believe that that's the best way to go. And I think it's important to talk about this because I think more people need to be aware of the different fee structures out there, because a financial planner is such an important part to having financial success in life. And so we need to be aware. So I'm just curious, what led you to, you know, buy into the flat fee model?
I would point to my time in corporate America. You know, 10 years I spent in a commission-based job. You know, there was also an AUM component to it. And I saw over and over again, I mean, I've been licensed in all 50 states, Puerto Rico, Guam. Like, I've had clients from all walks of life, all over the country. I could give you hundreds of examples of where this wasn't working for people. You know, and so when I left corporate finance and I said, okay, I'm going to launch my own firm, like, one of the first things that I sat down to do was figure out, well, what's going to be best for the client? You know, I can make a living on any of the fee models, but really what's going to make the most sense for the client? And a lot of the clients that I work with are entrepreneurial spirited, at least, you know, maybe they have their own business or a side hustle. They invest in real estate, right? Maybe they want to go buy a business like a laundromat or an RV park. All of these people, what they have in common is they need liquidity. They need to be able to make investments outside the stock market, right? You don't get rich typically by diversifying. Diversification is to help you from losing money, right? Some of the most successful people make these targeted bets, whether that's on a business or an investment that they're going to make. And so for me, when I looked at flat fee, I loved the fact that I didn't have any sort of conflicts of interest in the sense that I wasn't needing to sell them a product. That was rampant in corporate finance, and it made me sick. Like, I think of certain areas of the world that I worked in, Silicon Valley most recently, there was a ton of sales pressure to sell people annuities and managed accounts and things they frankly just didn't need. You know, I was meeting with people very successful in their 30s who did not need annuities, but the constant, almost daily message was sell this person annuities. I didn't want to have that sort of commission factor in my business. I didn't want to feel any sort of pressure to sell anybody anything. And so for me, it made a lot of sense for flat fee. And then on the flip side, I ran into this all the time in corporate America as well. You know, someone wants to take money out of their accounts to make another investment. Let's just say they want to buy a rental property. Well, if I'm an AUM advisor, meaning I pay a percentage of my portfolio to that advisor, the advisor is incentivized to sort of collect assets, right? It's an asset collection model. It's like, just let's build this as big as we can because my fee will continually go up. Well, what happens if someone takes $200,000 out to go buy a home, right? The advisor's fee goes down. Well, there's another conflict of interest for me. And so for the people that I was working with and just my past experience in finance, flat fee made a lot of sense because it was very transparent in the sense that I could meet with someone, we could look at net worth. I could say, here's your flat fee. It's not going to change if the market goes up, if you add money to your portfolios, if you take money out and you go buy that investment property. The flat fee will be the same. I can advise you on all of it. And I'm not making money or commission on any of it. It's just that flat fee. It makes it easy for everybody to know what they're going to pay. And to me, it just seemed a lot more fair for everybody involved.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I've found the flat fee structure allows me to have real conversations with people, real relationships with people, where I treat them like an adult that I respect, and they're paying me simply for the knowledge and the expertise. I had one client recently that was telling me about how his former advisor that charged a percent of his account, like every time he wanted to pull money out, they were giving him a hard time about it. And he felt like a child asking his parents for an allowance, you know, and that should never be the case. You know, he also said he wanted to pay off his mortgage, and his advisor comes back to him and says, well, no, you shouldn't do that. And this is back when interest rates were low. You shouldn't do that because you can, you have a low interest rate on that mortgage, and you can invest that money and you can make more than what you're paying in interest on the loan. And yes, that makes 100, that makes sense. There's no doubt. You can't dispute that from a mathematical standpoint, but there's also the emotional side of money. And you know what? He didn't want to have a damn mortgage. He didn't want to have debt. You know, that's a burden on people's shoulders sometimes. So yeah, I like the fact that the flat fee allows you to have these real conversations with people and really help them. And yeah, as far as commission products, I mean, I think that goes without saying. More often than not, a product, the primary objective is for the company selling the product to make money. The secondary objective is to help the client.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty cut and dry. So I appreciate you sharing your thoughts there. So Josh, I'm curious, what's like the most egregious thing you've seen as far as, you know, the industry not putting clients' interests first?
I mean, we've been talking about it, right? And there's so many different one-off examples I could give, but it is that reliance on AUM, on commission-based products. I'll give like a broad example first, and maybe I'll start to go a little more targeted. But I think of all the retirees that I worked at in you know, the big box finance company that I worked for. And there was always this goal to be very, very conservative in their retirement planning, make sure they kept their assets high, right? There'd be a lot of people passing away with hundreds of thousands of dollars that didn't necessarily have the goal to leave an inheritance, right? And part of that was, well, if they have $500,000 in their account, we can charge them X. When in the reality is, you know, with the clients I work with now, there is a lot of people who want to sort of die with zero, right? They want to live the best life that they possibly can with the money that they save. And I feel the same way. Like at this point in my life, I will probably be that person as well who wants to die with zero, not leave that inheritance. And when you're working off of a commission-based model and an asset collection model, that's just not your reality. I worked with a lot of good people, you know, at that company, and I don't think that they are doing it in a malicious way. But I think when you have someone across from you and how you put food on the table is selling them, you know, this annuity that they may or may not need, you have that conflict of interest in the back of your mind. And it leads to, shall I say, not the best outcomes, right? I think of the time in Silicon Valley where, you know, there was a ton of pressure from my management to sell annuities, which is crazy for people in their 30s making that kind of money. They did not need annuities. Planning was sort of thrown out the window and replaced by, you know, selling things for commissions. That really turned me off. That was the beginning of the end for me, where I started saving to leave that company. So yeah, those are some of the most egregious things, you know, and there's a million examples, but the commission-based products get in the way of planning all the time. How could they not?
Yeah. Die with zero. That's such a compelling concept. I actually have not yet read the book. Have you read the book?
Mm-hmm.
You have? Okay. Yep. I still need to check that out, but I understand, you know, the concept behind it. And it's just, it makes so much sense to me. Like, use your money to maximize the quality of your life right now, you know? And if you maximize the quality of your life right now, you're probably going to be a happier, more productive person. And happy, productive people tend to do pretty well financially now and in the future.
Yeah.
So what's your take on, you know, that mentality versus, you know, the historical mentality in our business, where it's always about planning for the future. It's always about sacrificing today to plan for the future. How do you sort of balance that with clients about planning for today and for the future?
You know, one thing I've learned since launching my own firm is you got to listen to the clients and potential clients, right? You have to listen to the people and what they want, because after spending, you know, 12 years in corporate America finance, really bought into this message of like sacrifice now, plan for later. It's like ingrained in us as CFPs, right? That's what we learned to do mathematically, maximize, maximize. Well, last year I wrote, 50 blog posts, and far and away, the most popular one was, how do I take 6 months off from my job and sort of reassess, maybe start a business or get a new job? But really the message behind it was, I'm unhappy in my corporate America job. How do I save up and take a 6 month sabbatical? And I was shocked that that was the most popular one by far. I actually wrote it for a client who wanted to do that, and then just kind of threw it up on the website. But so many people gravitated towards that, that it was a light bulb moment for me to say, wow, like this is really what people are looking for. It's not, you know, how to figure out if my 401k offers Roth, or, you know, how do I balance an investment portfolio? Like, those things are important, but I think people rely on us for that sort of thing. When they think about their own lives and what can I actually do with my money, their mind goes to all the things that they love to do, the things that they can provide for their family, right? People aren't like, man, I can't wait in 30 years to, you know, walk on the beach, you know, in retirement. Like, people's minds don't think that way. And the reality is we might not even make it to, you know, 30 years out. Anything can happen in life. And so for me, like through all the life planning curriculum, it was very eye-opening of, it doesn't have to be an either or. It can be a both. You know, you should be budgeting to live an amazing life now and saving for the future.
Yeah, I think a big part of that comes down to how much we need. A lot of people don't really realize how much they actually need, how much is enough for them, you know, and it comes down to getting very clear on who you are and understanding your values and, you know, to your point, understanding your money scripts and how they've influenced your financial decisions and your perspective on how much you need, all of those things. So I'm sure you have lots of conversations with clients about this.
If I could just jump in, what I'm thinking of, I think a perfect example for this, with almost all my clients, at some point in the first year, we'll go through what's called the Kinder questions. So if someone's not familiar, George Kinder sort of pioneered this concept of life planning. And there's three questions that he uses as part of his process. And so these questions are really along the lines of, like, if you won the lottery, right, you just have this infinite amount of money now, how would your life change? What would you do differently? Second question goes on to say, hey, you've got 5 years left to live. What would you do in the next 5 years? Like, how would you change your life now? It's sort of a progression, right? And question three is, you know, you're going to die tomorrow. What do you regret not doing? It can be this really emotional series of questions that you go through with clients, but the truth comes out, right? What is most important to them comes out. And it's never like cruise the Mediterranean in a mega yacht, right? It's not some like untouchable, crazy expensive thing. It's usually like, I want to, you know, walk my son to the bus stop, or I want to be able to go on a date night once a month with my wife. Like, they're totally attainable things that don't cost a lot of money, that really, like, I think the word that comes to mind for me is intentionality. Like, a big part of what I help people do is be more intentional with money. Like, it's a huge, I don't want to say problem, but it's very common for people everywhere across cultures to get paid and go and spend the money, right? It's human nature. What I try to help people do is be more intentional. You get paid, and the very first thing we should be doing is putting some money aside for the things that are the most meaningful for you. If that's date night, well, then you're going to set up an account and we're going to call it date night. And that's, you know, you're going to have direct deposit go in there before anything else. You want to protect that money from your, you know, Friday afternoon self who wants to go out and blow a bunch of money. You want to set that aside first and foremost, because we've determined that is the most meaningful thing to you. And that's going to move the needle the most when it comes to happiness and fulfillment and some of these things that people don't think about that are super important and tied in with money, but are overlooked in this kind of traditional corporate finance CFP type model, where it's like, just maximize, you know, and don't get me wrong, there are milestones you can hit, you know, you get $1 million in your 401k. That feels good, but walking your son to the bus stop for 10 years, you know, that's never going to come close to $1 million. It's just not.
Yeah. 100%. You know, we talk about all the time how money is simply a tool. You can live a great life. Money can help you live an even better life and increase the quality of your life, but it's not something to just incessantly try to accumulate and maximize. And I love what you said there about, first and foremost, when you get paid, make sure it's being allocated to the things that are most important. I like to view every dollar spent as an investment. It's an investment in the quality of my life, you know, and then investments like in the traditional sense, in investment portfolio or real estate or wherever, that's an investment in the future, but it's all an investment. And I think we need to respect money in that way. Kind of going back to the concept of die with zero, another thing I wanted to touch on is, again, in the traditional sense of our industry, when we think of legacy planning, you know, like estate planning, we always think of the amount of money that we're going to leave behind to our kids, or, you know, we're going to try to get our name on a building or something like that. You know, we want to leave money behind, but like what you're describing here of having those relationships, being able to walk your kid to the bus stop, like, I think that maybe is a better way to start thinking about legacy versus financial. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's spot on. I mean, I've had these conversations with clients where I think there's almost a stigma of like, I should do this. You know, there's this sort of subconscious belief with so many people, whether it's cultural or the books that they've read or the messaging in the media of, you know, oh, wouldn't it be great to just leave a trust fund to my kid, you know? And then we talk about it and it's like, you know, for what? What do you think they'll use it for? What do you hope that they'll use it for? Because you can do that in a trust, right? You could dictate and say, hey, the only things that this can be used for is to buy a house or, you know, put my grandkids through college or something along those lines. But it's, you know, a lot of times when you dig a little bit deeper, it's like, well, wouldn't it be more meaningful to help them buy that house now? You know, and then you can spend time with your grandkids in that house. Why are you waiting?
Yeah.
You know, is it more meaningful? And for a lot of people, the answer is no. Like, I think I'm yet to meet someone who really wants their name on a building. You know, I've met with clients who have upwards of $50 million and they weren't thinking about putting their name on a building. They were thinking about all the same things as everyone else, spending time with family, you know, taking family on trips, minimizing risk, right? With the time that they have left, like it always comes back to time. No matter how much money you have, like I think at this point in my career and having worked with people of all ranges of wealth, it really does boil down to time. Like, you know, you'll never think that you have enough money. The guy with 50 million is looking at his neighbor who has 100 million and he's disgruntled because he's not there. It's, you got to kind of zoom out and look at the bigger picture and figure out, well, am I enjoying my life? Am I fulfilled? You know, am I working 70 hours a week and can't even spend this money? You know, so money is tied into everything. It's amazing to me always, even still, how much conversations around money evolve into all these other facets of life.
Yeah. And have you heard, I don't know if there's, I can't quote any specific studies or statistics, but I'm sure they're out there. But in terms of the percentage of inheritances that end up being squandered because the kids like don't have the values and they don't understand how to use that money. Have you seen those?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think, so there's that aspect of it. The money gets blown, right? Especially if you don't do adequate estate planning and you just say, here's a brokerage account with $400,000 in it and they can literally do whatever they want with it. You know, it makes me, especially when the parent was my client, it makes me scratch my head and say, wow, is this really what they wanted to be done with it? And then on the emotional side of it, I've seen it tear families apart where, you know, siblings inherit money. Maybe they inherit different amounts and there's animosity. You know, there's a lot of moving parts that go into leaving money. Like ideally, you want to have that conversation ahead of time before you're gone and say, you know, hey, this is the reasoning behind why I'm leaving what I'm leaving to each of you. Because it can be extremely emotional. I've seen people who refuse to spend the inheritance. You know, oh no, I have an emotional attachment. You know, my mom, you know, invested in Apple in, you know, 1994, and I never want to sell that. And so I'm just going to sit on it forever and I'll give it to my grandkids. And, you know, it causes all sorts of other emotional, you know, I don't want to say problems, but factors that we need to work through as like financial planner and client. So inheritances are just so emotionally charged. You know, it's really like you got to work with both parties. In my opinion, you know, you have to talk to the person who's leaving the money and be like, well, this is the money that you saved. This really is still your money. What do you want to happen with this? A lot of times trust can be helpful because you can really dictate, you know, well, they can't get to the money till they're 30 or 35, or they can only use it for these reasons. So there is a degree of control you can still have, but I think the conversation still needs to happen with the person inheriting the money. So they understand the why and they're not mad at you once you're gone that you didn't let them have access to the money and you never explained why. So kind of a long-winded answer to your question. But yeah, I mean, there's so many different factors when it comes to money, like just that inheritance one alone, you know, the emotional ties that people have to money are so strong that it can like ruin relationships.
Yeah, I think of that old saying of, you know, you can teach a man to fish or you can give him a fish. Like if you just leave a big inheritance behind, you're just leaving a pile of fish. Or you can, over the course of your life while you're here, maximize the time with those people that you want to leave money to, build those relationships and leave, you know, create a legacy while you're here and teach them how to fish when you're gone. You know, so that's kind of what pops into my head. Switching gears here. So you're somebody like myself who left a corporate job to start your own business. And a big part of that is planning the finances, right? I think that's a big part of what keeps people from pursuing work that might be more meaningful to them and might actually help them live a happier life. So how did you go about that, about making that transition, both from a, I guess, psychological standpoint and from a money standpoint?
Yeah, the psychological standpoint, I'll say, was the easy part because I was so disgruntled in the job that I was in. I was just deeply unhappy. It didn't align any longer with the company or their values or how they were charging people. Like there were so many things that I could point to. It really was like the straw that broke the camel's back for me, where I was like, man, I'm done. And I knew I was done. But to your point, I needed to plan the financial runway. So I talk about that in that blog post that I wrote, how to take 6 months off, because that was originally my goal. You know, I looked at other firms versus starting my own, really came to the conclusion of like, I want to own the client experience. I want to create something world class and really put it out there in the world and make it my own. And so that's what led me down the path to actually launching my own firm. But at first, I wasn't sure. I knew I needed to leave, wasn't sure what my next steps were. So I got to work. I mean, I had an escape fund really and saved as much as I possibly could for close to a year to build up that financial runway. I, you know, I have side hustles. I rent my motorcycle. You know, I have an Airbnb. Now I'm a professor. Like I have these other income streams that'll help. And I kind of designed my life in that way to say, okay, well, I want to put myself in a position where it's not like I have to make this work in 3 months. I want to have a year, 2 years, you know, runway to be able to get up to speed in my business. I knew that was going to be important, but it meant staying at that job a little bit longer than I probably wanted to or needed to in order to aggressively save. I mean, for that year, I, you know, cut my expenses, which is something that I don't really like to do. I, you know, focused on the side hustles. I focused on, you know, just saving as much as I possibly could so that I could put myself in a good position, you know, and have enough runway to make this other venture work.
Where do you think somebody should begin? This is what I think about a lot as I'm having conversations with people, and each person is totally different. But what's your take on where do people begin to try to determine what kind of a runway they'll need to make a career transition? And again, to be clear, this doesn't have to mean you're going out on your own to start your own business. It could mean, you know, you're just going to maybe take a step back in your career. Maybe you're going to move to, you know, a new industry, something that you're more passionate about, starting at a lower level, you know, so that you can work your way up. But you have to, you know, be prepared to maybe take a cut in your pay temporarily. So I'm just curious, how do you advise people start to kind of think about what kind of a runway would be appropriate for them?
The first thing I'll say is it's always going to be more than you think, right? Like maybe even double. You can do as much projecting into the future as you want. And I talk about this in the article that I wrote, but it's like, if you're going to take off 6 months, figure out what your expenses are, right? And you're going to need 6 months of those. So let's say it's $4,000 a month. You know, you need at least $24,000, and you probably should double that number to have an emergency fund. That way, if there's a medical emergency, your car breaks down during this period of time that you're not working, you have to have those reserves, because there's nothing like an accident to completely derail your plans, right? Well, I've got 6 months saved, I'm fine. And then in month two, you total your car and, you know, your spouse gets injured, and all of a sudden all of your savings goes to that and you no longer can take any time off. And so the first thing I would say is, like, is it's important to run the numbers, get a base level of what you know that you need to have at a minimum. And then also make a list of some of the other resources that you have available to you. A lot of people discount some of the accounts that they were saving in corporate America, right? Most people have some sort of savings in a 401k. You don't want to lean on that, but you know what? In the example of the car accident and spouse is injured, maybe you need to. And you know what? It's not the end of the world. If that really is your next chapter and you're pursuing something that's going to 10X your fulfillment in life, I say go for it. Lean on the 401k. Take some of that money out if you need to, right? And that's sort of counterintuitive coming from a financial advisor, right? Because we're taught to maximize and never touch the 401k until you're 59 and a half. But the reality is, like, you know, it might happen where you blow through those savings. You know, not everything is going to work out like you thought. Even in my own business, you know, are clients flooding through the doors as fast as I would like? No, probably not. But, you know, if they were to come any faster, I don't know if I could handle that sort of flow either. And so it's like, in hindsight, you know, I probably could have saved more before launching this business to have even more of a comfortable runway. You will just never know. So run the numbers, figure out conservatively, like, okay, this is sort of my benchmark bare minimum, but be prepared to go get a part-time job or a side hustle, or dip into accounts that you might not have thought of dipping into before. If you really have a dream, I say, go for it.
Man, I love that. It's so refreshing to talk to another financial advisor that's kind of on the same page as me, as far as, like, it's okay to break rules sometimes, like these arbitrary rules. You can't touch your 401k or IRA until you're 59 and a half. And it's like, why? You know, if I take a little bit out, I think of it just as like I'm pulling future assets forward to help me today. And there's nothing wrong with that. If it's going to help me build a better life today that is ultimately going to lead to a better future, I'll gladly pay a 10% penalty on the withdrawal that I take out, knowing that another 20 years of compounding is going to more than make up for that. So I don't think there's any problem with doing that sometimes.
No, not at all.
I mean, it's, again, to your point, it's not going to be your go-to. That's not what you want to rely on when you leave your job. And I agree with you. Make sure you have more than you think you're going to need outside of those retirement assets. But look at all of your assets as, like, these are different levers that you have to pull to accomplish whatever it is that you need to accomplish. And we need to be having these holistic conversations about where you're headed.
Yeah.
Josh, one last thing I want to ask you is, what's your definition of wealth? Because, you know, if you look up wealth in the dictionary, it's going to talk about people who have a lot of money. But you and I both agree that wealth is something that each person should individually define for themselves. So can you tell us a little bit about your perspective on wealth?
Yeah, for sure. And I'll tie it back into what you were just talking about, too, because tomorrow isn't promised, you know, and I keep thinking about that in the context of financial life planning. I can't tell you how many people I've worked with who passed away early before they ever got to use a penny out of their 401k. And so in hindsight, if you were to ask those people, well, would you have wanted to take some money out of that and go on that trip you always wanted to go on to Italy with your wife and pay a 10% penalty? Like, obviously, right? No brainer. They never use the money anyway. And so to tie that in with my definition of wealth, for me, wealth building is about freeing up my time. For me, it's, you know, if I can work smarter, not harder, right? I have no desire to go work 60 hours again, like I did in corporate America. For me, it's about creating this ideal life for me and for my family to be able to help the people that I love and that I care about. If the need arises, you know, just just be able to free up time in my own life using money, whether that's, you know, passive income streams or living off investments that I have. I want to be able to have the flexibility to live the life I want without financial constraints. So if that means tomorrow I wake up and I decide that I want to go to Spain for 90 days, well, you know, I want to financially be able to do that. I want the constraint to be, well, I've got clients I got to take care of. And, you know, maybe my wife doesn't want to do that or whatever it is. But I don't want the reason to be, well, financially, I'm not able to do that. Right. I don't want to have financial constraints. If I have a dream of something I want to do, if I want to take a road trip on my motorcycle, I want to be able to do that and not be financially constrained. I want my business to support time freedom, to be able to say, you know, obviously in advance, but say, hey, clients, I'm taking off July to go on a motorcycle road trip. And I financially want to be able to do that. And I want my finances to be able to support that. I want my accounts to be set up in a way where I can turn on income if necessary, and then turn it back to growth if necessary. But I want it to be fluid. Like, I've never really bought into this traditional, like, go work at the same company for 40 years. And then when you're 67, you know, hopefully you're still able to walk on the beach or sit in the rocking chair and read the newspaper or whatever. Like, I've never really bought into that. I want to live the best life I possibly can now while saving a modest amount along the way that will take care of me down the line.
Well said. All right. Well, Josh, it was great having you on, man. I appreciate you coming on. And if the listeners want to learn a little bit about more about you and what you do, where should they go?
Wealthinyourself.com is a good place to start. I'm on social media. Most of the platforms are Wealth in Yourself or Josh St. Laurent. I'll send them over to you to just drop in the show notes. But I'm active on LinkedIn and Instagram. I'm posting more videos on YouTube. But Wealth in Yourself would probably be a good place to start. Wealthinyourself.com.
Sounds good, my friend. Well, we'll talk again soon. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is fun.
Thanks for listening today. And if you have a moment, check out my website at reflectivewealth.com. Everything you need to know about my business is there. Because if there's one thing I've learned in my career, transparency and accountability are critical to a healthy financial services industry. Thanks and see you next time.